Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Surface. I am Brian Levinson. I created this podcast because I love the power of story, the power of journey. And I truly believe that we are all a compilation of the stories that we hear and the stories that we tell ourselves. I work as a mental performance coach right outside of Washington, D.C., where I get to work with all kinds of interesting people and interesting organizations. And over the years, I've been privy to some amazing stories. And I've learned about how those stories have impacted people's mindsets. So this podcast will aim to go deep with interesting people who consider themselves to be performers. And we'll find out about how their stories have impacted their mindsets and how they've developed those mindsets for performance. We'll dig deep to find out how they see the world. We'll also dig deep into how they see themselves as performers in whatever it is that they do. As we go beyond the surface with them, I encourage you to go beyond the surface with yourself as well. Today we go beyond the surface with Duke Women's Basketball Associate Head Coach Hernando Planels. I got connected to Hernando by Coach Jessica Kern, who was on the podcast last week, and she said, you got to talk to Hernando. So I'm really excited to talk to him today. Hernando wears a lot of different hats, but the one that he's known most for is coaching and coaching women's basketball at one of the highest levels where he coaches at Duke University with their women's basketball team. Hernando has had quite a journey, as you'll hear about. He's coached in the D-League. He's coached in Japan. He's coached at UNLV with men's basketball. He's coached all kinds of different people all over the world. And he'll share some of the stories that he experienced. And he'll be pretty frank and honest about some of the bumps along the way. As you'll tell from his story, he's a driven guy. He's someone who's not afraid to take a risk. He's not afraid to do things differently. He's not afraid to go outside of his lane and try something new. And I think that's part of the reason why Hernando has been successful as a coach and why he's coaching at one of the top programs in the country. The other thing that I really like about Hernando is he's entrepreneurial. So you'll hear about his podcast. You'll hear about him starting up businesses. You'll hear about him doing things outside of sports, all to try to learn, all to try to grow, and all to try to make a living. So I think you'll really enjoy Hernando's story, his journey, and also his mindset and how he interprets different experiences. So without further ado, I present to you Hernando Planels. Hernando, why don't you start? Tell me about what life was like for you as a child. What was your family like? What was your upbringing like?
Well, you know, I grew up, my dad is Hispanic, but he's from Spain, but was raised in Colombia. And my mom is from the Philippines, so I kind of get that cross-cultural upbringing, which means I was spanked a lot, chased me around the house. I think my mom would always like tell me to put my hands out, and she'd take a wooden spoon and try and hit my hands all the time. And but it was really strict, yet a lot of fun, a lot of love in the house. Growing up, they would argue, they'd get after each other as well too. I still remember, like, to this day, like Saturday morning was a time where they were like, kind of get into it. But through it all, like, my mom always, like, she really, really believed I was going to do really great things. She's a very religious woman, prayed every single day, even to this day, takes credit for everything I've done because of the power of her prayer. And my dad was sort of like a really silent, strong type. The reality is that, you know, growing up, you kind of think that your dad doesn't like you, or because he doesn't talk. But as you get older, you kind of realize, hey, that's not it. It's something totally, totally different. And I took a lot of great things in terms of how his work ethic, what he wanted to do, how he just really focused on something and move forward. So it was kind of everywhere. It was great because now I really grew up in a very big cultural home. So I can go, I've been blessed to go all over the world and just kind of dive into whatever culture it is and feel like I'm at home.
Do you identify with one of those cultures? If someone were to ask you to identify, I was just at the doctor today and they asked me like my race. And the woman said, she's like, I always feel uncomfortable asking people that. And I said, it's like, yeah, how do you like check a box for that? So then I thought about people that were like mixed in different races and how weird that might be for them. What do you identify with as far as culture or ethnicity or race, or how do you even look at that question?
Yeah, you know, for a long time, it really felt like I didn't have a home, you know, and in some ways I kind of don't, you know. So I grew up on the really on the Filipino side in terms of the food, the culture, but then a heavy influence with Spanish. A lot of it is because Spain was in the Philippines for a while, but I don't speak Tagalog, which is the Philippine, you know, kind of main language. I only know the bad words. My mom would yell at me all the time. And I don't speak Spanish. Now, what that forced me to do, though, was forced to almost become like a chameleon in many ways. So it's they make fun of me on staff here. Like, I can go to Spain or Mexico, and I'm like, hola, ¿cómo estás? You know, and just get by, right? Or I can go to Asia and still, like, understand the customs from – I coach in Japan, so from the chopsticks to, like, the Filipino native tongue, all these different things. I mean, it's – so it's – it's kind of hard because my kids are also mixed as well too. So as time goes on, they're losing that sort of culture that was brought up, but they're learning their own culture with it. But the reality is I'm a chameleon, which can be good and bad.
We'll talk about culture later in the podcast, but you know, that word has multiple meanings to it, but it is interesting to think about, like, as our society becomes more mixed, which I think in a lot of ways is a beautiful thing, like, right? Like,
yes.
We shouldn't all be isolated with our own people. But there's also something beautiful about culture and having pride in your heritage and who you are and what you are, what that is. So I find that to be fascinating. You mentioned mom had a faith and religion was a big part of her sort of system. How do you interpret faith? How do you look at faith and think about religion?
Well, I think it's a really big belief in a higher power. And for me, it was God. You know, we prayed every day. She had this thing where she'd go ahead and pray Psalm 91, which basically was like the protection of you, that you're always going to be protected. You're always going to, no matter what happens, you're always going to be protected. So it was sort of like that. So like, as I grew up, I actually for a while, I thought, man, my mom prays all the time. What is going on? You know, and as I get older, how do I say this? I don't lean on faith, but faith is a big part of me. I think in our society today, we always are looking for a crutch, whether it's a group of friends, whether it's faith, whether it's my job, whatever it is. But it's just really become a part of me where I know it's there. I got to sharpen it like I have to do everything else in my life. So it's become something that is like a pillar for me, not something I lean on, not something I like it's my crutch, but know that it's there and I could turn to it when I need it and when I don't even need it.
And you sort of said mom and dad maybe had some emotion in their relationship or passion or anger.
All of the above is good.
Did they stay together, get divorced? What's their story?
No, they did. So my father went to go work in the Philippines in 1974, married my mom in 1975, brought her here to the United States in 75. I was born in 76. And they were married all the way till he passed away 14 years ago, because my daughter is 14. So and they were married the whole time. And it was an interesting dynamic because you're seeing my mom is running to do everything. And my dad was very stoic, didn't say a whole lot, loved to little dance or salsa or whatever he used to do. And they just stayed together and were strong. And just like in any married couple is that, you know, you have some instances where you're strong and some parts where you're weak. And they tried to balance each other out. They worked very well. And I learned a lot of different lessons from them because of that.
My wife and I always say, and we often talk about it when we go to weddings, is, you know, the best relationships seem to be the ones where each person makes the other better. And hopefully our marriage is that. I know my side of it is that she makes me better.
Right.
I have my doubts some days that I'm actually making her better. I want to go back to childhood. Did you have siblings? Is it just you and mom and dad? And where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I grew up in Los Angeles. I have one younger sister, but there's 10 of us. So my mom had had 8 kids in the Philippines. And then when she came here, she had myself and my younger sister, who's 3 years younger. So there's 10 of us. I've been to the Philippines for work and just to go visit them. And it's great. It's like I go there and no one believes me that I'm a Filipino, because I'm taller than everybody except for the basketball players, and I'm taller than my family. So there's 10 of us. I grew up in Los Angeles, grew up in a very fortunate home. My dad was a mechanical engineer, worked for Disney, worked for a lot of different companies, and my mom was a librarian. So really grew up in a really strong home in terms of like what you see in examples on how to be, you know, a good person, a good man, along with faith, but also the different things you have to deal with in life that comes with the different cultures.
Values, morals were instilled in you. What were some of those values? What were some of the morals? Are there any stories that you remember besides mom sort of smacking you with a spoon or mom sort of praying? Is there any sort of life lessons that maybe your dad taught you or your mom taught you from a young age that has stuck with you?
Yeah, you know, grew up in a very Catholic home. So it was, and since my mama is full of faith, a lot of those things were rooted inside of me. And my father was Catholic as well too, but he wasn't a guy who went to church every Sunday. But my dad kind of taught me just to sit back and watch everything. Like, my dad was a man of very few words, and he'd always just sit, listen, and give his two cents. The one great thing about my dad is that he never put pressure to go ahead to be a great athlete, to be a great worker. He just said, you have to do the right thing. And he always expected you to do certain things so that you can be better. And there were times where he was upset, didn't like the choices I made, and he would let me know about it. But he would never rant or rave. Now, my mom, on the other hand, is the more emotional type. She was the more who's, you know, she called me Junior. Junior, you have to do this. Junior, you have to do that. Okay, mom, okay, okay. Even to this, she's 76 years old. She says the exact same thing to me like when I was 13, 14 years old. But, you know, the values were always the same. It was always like, do the right thing, be a good person, you know, do what God wants you to do, follow in faith. Got to keep on believing. And those were echoed from two different people, my mom and my dad. And yeah, they were worried about different things. I mean, perfect example, you know, I was 21 years old. And at the time I got my girlfriend pregnant and then decided to marry her. My dad wasn't a big fan of it. You know, my mom was like, okay, you know, but my dad was, you know, he told me, he let me know what his opinion was. And to this day, I see it, I understand it, and I try and pass it on to my kids because, you know, I was married for 13 years. I'm divorced now. So you learn those lessons from it, and you see certain things that they saw that I didn't see at the time.
You hit on something that is so valuable. So I work with a lot of high school kids, and the parents will often ask me, and I'm based in the area I grew up in. So a lot of people know me, but they also know my family. And I have two brothers, and all of us are pretty entrepreneurial, and I think we're pretty good humans, and my parents are pretty good humans. So a lot of people will ask, like, hey, Brian, like, what were you guys doing in your house? Like, what did your mom and dad teach you? Like, did they teach you to be great? Like, how did they teach you to be great and this, that, and the other? And I always go back to the memories and the lessons that I have as a kid are very much around character. The lessons were around doing right or doing wrong or treating people a certain way and how you treat people and the way that we talk and the way that we interact with other humans. And there's a great book called The Road to Character by a guy named David Brooks, who's a big-time writer for the New York Times.
Okay.
In the book, he talks about focusing on your eulogy or focusing on your resume. And the idea being that if you focus on your resume, you know, those are things that you do, but they're not necessarily who you are. And he says our society as a whole, not just millennials, our society as a whole really values resume items and values greatness, right? And really values greatness. And his point in the book is really that if you focus on eulogy items, if you focus on character items and goodness, then the greatness will take care of itself. But if you focus on the greatness, if you focus on the resume items, that doesn't necessarily translate over to goodness. And it's a fascinating thought and a concept. And I think back to my childhood and listening to you talk, the first thing you said was, they really taught me right and wrong. Like, it wasn't so much like you need to do this in basketball or this or that. It was just like, hey, let's do things right or wrong. And we're both in the sports space where, look, we run into parents who are trying to help their kids be great, and they do it with amazing intention. But I wonder what our society would look like if everybody just focused on, let's just be a person of character. Now, a person of character could be like your dad. It could be putting your work in, providing for your family, being stoic. But it also could look like your mom. It can have some more emotion. It can be a person of faith. You know, it doesn't have to look one specific way. But I do wonder if we would all be better off with just that idea and that concept of let's coach our kids to be kids of character, and then let's coach each other to be people of character. And it's a broad word, but I just think that word is so important. I want to get your thoughts also, because it sounds like there's also a major event that happens 14 years ago. So tell me about what it's like to lose your dad, who sounds like kind of a rock of a human being. What was that like for you personally? And you know, that's obviously a massive experience to go through.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. I look back at it now, and when it happened, it wasn't huge until – 2 or 3 years later. What I mean by not being huge is he was sick for a while, and I was with him in the hospital the whole time. What really happens is my daughter was born, and I hadn't gone to see him in 3 months. So I went to go see him to bring my daughter to go see her. And I went to the house. He had lost like 30 pounds. I mean, he looked absolutely awful. My mom took him to the hospital, and about a month later, he passed away. And at the time, it was sort of like surreal. Like I knew obviously he passed away. I was there and everything else, but I didn't really allow it to like affect me in many ways. And I now look at it now, I think it was because I was on my own journey to in many ways prove what I can do to him as well too. My father was big on, hey, you know what, whatever you do, it's fine, but you got to get a job. And at the time I was chasing, you know, coaching, movies, everything in the book, just trying to make things work. And it only happened about probably 2 or 3 years later. I was coaching in Japan, and my father had a brother that actually he met 5 years before he passed away. Never knew he had a brother. 5 years before he passed away, met this guy who looks like him, sounds like him, and everything. And
where was his brother? Somewhere else in the world?
No, well, his brother was in San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
Yeah. So what ended up happening is that my grandfather was a traveling actor, and he decided to plant a bunch of seeds all over South America. So he was one of, I think, 27 or 28 siblings. I mean, sons and daughters that my grandfather had. Yay me. So he had met him 5 years before, and my mom said, hey, call him. He's sick. You know, call your tio, your uncle. So I called him, and I'm on the phone with him. I'm in Okinawa, Japan coaching, and we were having the worst season ever. And he gets on the phone and he says, hello, mijo, which is me, is my son. And I started to cry because it was like talking to my dad. I could not believe it. He was just talking, just seeing how I was doing and everything else, telling me everything was going to be okay. It was the craziest thing. And I hung up and I sobbed, and it was like, I either talked to my dad or I spoke to my uncle or whatever it is, but it was like, wow, this is crazy. And for a while, like for the rest of that season, I remember like really missing my dad because it was almost like I allowed that emotion to hit in many ways. And then from there kind of say, wow, you know, these are the different things my dad had taught me and helped me along the way. And it just came rushing in. So that was a crazy part for me.
Are you more similar to mom or dad?
It's crazy. You know, like my personality and how I'm out there and talking all the time is my mom. But as I get older, I see some of my dad tendencies, such as like, everybody get away from me. Like everything is going way too slow for me. I need to hurry things up. So it's been very interesting sitting back and watching the evolution of how it is and not fighting it, because you mentioned something earlier before just about how I was raised. One of the things that I really, really preach for my parents is that they did not put, I don't know how to say this, but in every culture, there's an expectation because of that culture, you know? So for example, and the comedian, Joe Coy, he's a Filipino guy, talks about all the time that Filipinos are usually all nurses, right? And my mom never, ever put that on me. She said, Junior, I believe you can do anything you want. You could do it. If you want to be a nurse, great. If you don't, great. There was never those shackles on. My dad was the exact same way. So, you know, having that along with my parents, and then when my dad passed away, pushing myself to do different things than what I guess other people would do, helped me push forward and helped me get through it to this day.
Do you consider yourself someone who likes to go against the grain or against the norm? Is that something, you know, going against the expectation of where maybe you're supposed to be or what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, when my son was born, when my son was born, I had a choice, right? But I had no college education. I was coaching at a high school. I had a choice to either go ahead and get a 9-to-5 job, work in insurance, do the, you know, quote unquote right thing and support the family and everything else. Or I go in a completely different direction and push the limits as much as I possibly can to believe that, you know, all the stuff my mom was feeding me, whether it was BS or not, like I really believe it. I can get somewhere. I don't know where I'm going to go, but I can get somewhere. So I kept pushing that side and saying, listen, if I did that, then I become a great example for my kids, right? I can't tell my kids that they can do something great if they don't have an example of it. You know, and if your dad and mom are your examples, are supposed to be a pretty big examples, then what do you do? So I really pushed that side on the envelope and saying, no, I'm going to do totally something different than what I'm supposed to do. Even now in my job here at Duke, I do things differently than a lot of other coaches, whether it's the speaking engagements or when I work on movies, something totally different because it's what I love to do. I just love trying to find different ways to do it and in many ways kind of proving people wrong and proving myself that I can do it at the same time.
I want to just go back to childhood. So basketball, did basketball come into your life early? When did it come into your life? What was high school like for you? If you could just break that down for us, that'd be great.
You know, not really. I played all the different sports. I went to an all boys Catholic high school. My mom said, you are not going to be around women in high school. It's probably a very good thing for me. So she really said, hey, you know, so I went through, and I was okay. I was not great at all. It's funny. Like when you're like, I think every young man does it from like age 18 to like 34, you were the greatest athlete at your school. And then at age 34 on, you realize I sucked. I was not very good at all.
For me, it was much more 8 years old. like I that realization came very quickly when I was about 14, 15. But 8 years old, I remember I was probably like top five in the elementary school. Everybody grew. Everyone got big. Everyone got strong. Everyone got fast. Brian at eight was probably pretty similar to Brian at 14. But this isn't about me. This is your story, and then we'll go back to you. So,
but I love it, though, man. I love it.
But you were a good athlete in high school, so you're playing a bunch of
sports. I was okay. Yeah, I was okay.
And then you said, so why not go to college? How did that not come up, especially being at a Catholic school? I'm sure there were a lot of kids that were going off to college and doing that. What happened next after high school?
Yeah, so I did go away, didn't like it. I came back, went to junior college, and I was really just enamored in terms of just working. Like at the time, like, oh, I just want to make money. And, you know, my mom was like, all right, well, just go to school. And she didn't have to check up on me anymore. I didn't have to do it. So I would chip away. You know, I'd chip away at my schooling, and I'd chip away all the way. I'm 40 years old now. I finished my degree 5 years ago, actually. So I chipped away for 18 years. It was 17 years, 17, 18 years to finish my degree online at Regis University at a school that I've never set foot on in Denver, Colorado.
Did you struggle in academics in high school, or what were academics like for you? How do you make sense of it?
You know, I did not get good grades at all. I struggled. A lot of it was, I was just not interested in it at all. You know, it's funny. I as I'm older now, I realize that I learn differently. Like it's very hard for me to sit and pay attention to something for me to go ahead and remember and catch my attention. I always have to do something to do it. So I look back at it, and it was tough when the test came, because I would just go ahead and just skate my way through. And then when the test came, I was like, oh man, what am I going to do now? And it was like that. I just was not big into school at all. Which is funny, and I work at one of the highest academic institutions in the country.
I know, I had that in the back of my head, but I figured you're probably going to connect those dots at some point. You probably figured out, you know, Hernando's at Duke, which is like, you know, it's not hard to get into at all. And I'm assuming there's a bunch of dummies that are walking around your campus.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I am the least qualified person to work here at Duke. I say it all the time, and people are like, oh, you're ridiculous. No, I'm serious. Least qualified.
Well, yes and no, right? So, like, education's, and it's just it's fascinating to me. Like, you know, I was always fine at school. You know, I wasn't great. I wasn't terrible. I was fine. I was good enough. But I never was inspired in school. I was never enjoyed it. College more so, in grad school. When I went to grad school, I really enjoyed it because it was what I was so interested in. But yeah, I think we've made a mistake by correlating grades to intelligence.
Yes.
Just like we make the mistake of correlating IQ to how smart someone is. And by the way, the IQ was not designed to be a standardized test. It was designed to be a baseline. And actually, you can do a bunch of things to increase your IQ and retake it and raise your IQ. But we often say, oh, this person has this IQ and that's how smart they are. Like it's something that's set in stone. And it's not how the IQ test works. And it's not how it was created.
I'm scared to take the IQ test, by the way. I refuse to take it.
but you can cheat on it. Like you can improve on it based on environment, circumstance, situation, learning, growing. What I always tell my clients is like, if you're the same person, like let's say I'm working with an 18-year-old, I always say, if you're the same person when you're 35 that you are when you're 18, come to my office, knock on the door, open it and say, Brian, I haven't changed a bit, and I'll smack you in the face. I'll take that spoon that your mom has, and
That's right. Put your hands out. I'm going to hit you with the spoon.
Bam. Yeah, and I don't put hands on people. So I'm not that's not me. But you know what? For that, it might be necessary. So,
right.
I think we do make a mistake. That's not to say that education isn't important. That's not to say that, I hope my kids don't do well in school. Of course they do. And look, school's constantly evolving, constantly changing. There's new stuff being added to curriculums and there's new ways to engage students. And, I think our school system could do better, but they're trying and it'll continue to evolve and improve. But I don't think that, a degree makes you smarter than somebody. I don't think, the letters next to your name means that you're now an expert. I think it's a start, but it's not a finish. It's an opening. It's a door opening, but it's not necessarily mean that you're really competent. So,
right.
So you decide to sort of work a little bit. And then was it in your early 20s where you're like, I'm going to give this basketball coaching thing a shot? Is that when that started? You mentioned movies a little bit. You mentioned things. Walk me through the journey a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So, when my son was born, I ended up going to UNLV for a little bit, working and helping out their men's basketball program.
Because you mentioned UNLV, we got to know some times.
Yeah. So that was, let me see if I get it. So this was 2000, 2001.
Okay.
Is that right? Yeah. So 2001, Bill Bainham was the head coach, was let go in December. Which means that kind of left me out there in the cold as well too.
Welcome
so I
to
wanted
sports.
To
first welcome but, to sports moment, huh?
Yeah. Like, oh, hello. Welcome. and the crazy thing. So in the house was, my son, his mother and, my wife's at the time, 16-year-old brother. All right. And I'm 22 years old.
You're an adult, full-fledged adult at that point.
I'm trying to make things happen. So I go ahead and I finish out the semester, move back to LA, start working in insurance, and I responded to this ad looking for this sport, looking for coaches. And I went out there and it was like an audition or tryout, and it turned out in being slam ball, which was a full contact basketball and trampolines. I worked on that. I had a little hair and I was like 40 pounds heavier. And I was on TV. I looked horrible. Like the pictures, like if you look up slam ball and you see me, I mean, I literally look like I'm selling stuff on the side. I mean, that's how it looks like. But through there, I met a guy by the name of Mark Ellis, who basically choreographed all the different football movies. And he called me and said, hey, I need a basketball guy. Are you interested in doing it? And that first movie ended up being Coach Carter. So I trained all the actors and choreographed all the action. So it went on for – I did about 12 movies, over 30 commercials, but on and off work, right? So it's – I'm working for like 2 weeks or I work for like 3 months and then I'm back into training players or I'm coaching at a junior college, just trying to do everything and anything, basically surviving. And in the meantime, I'm emailing thousands of coaches, calling. I mean, I would call – like I wanted a job doing what I want to do. But the crazy thing is I really didn't know what I want to do. I said, coaching would be good. Working on movies would be good. So I would go ahead and at night I would call NBA teams because every company has a dial by name directory. So I'd call at 11 o'clock at night because no one's there. And I'd press the buttons all night long trying to find. I left messages for everybody. And two head coaches got back to me, Jeff Van Gundy when he was with the Rockets and Lon Kruger when he was with the Hawks. Wow. And they talked for like 10 minutes. But I did that. I learned that doing that busy work was so it would make me feel good like I'm doing something for my career. So in the meantime, I did that. I got a job working for Marty Blake, who was the director of scouting in the NBA.
Marty Blake So I used to have an NBA draft website, so I know who Marty Blake is. For those that don't know who Marty Blake is, give some more context there, because that name in NBA circles goes
it's huge. It goes
a long way. So just
explain
to people who he is and what he did, and just give us some.
I mean, he was probably like one of the original members of the NBA. Also worked in the ABA. Was a general manager for the Atlanta franchise. And he became the scouting guru, kind of got that whole world going, and was the director of scout for the NBA. And everybody knew Marty Blake, his stories, and his memory was unbelievable. He remembered me when I was coaching in Japan. He remembered me when I was just trying to work some games for them, and him and his son, Ryan, who I'm still, friends with today, both helped me out in terms of different careers. So I worked from there.
Just to jump in, so there are stories of Marty Blake calling potential NBA prospects and literally telling them, you need to go back to school. You're not going to get drafted. Or, GMs would rely on Marty Blake to figure out, how does their draft board look? And people forget, but this is like pre-internet. So, they were relying on magazines or articles,
right.
And there was no technology to go watch film and split film. I mean, where we are today in the scouting world is so different than what it was back in the day. But he was really the guy, and he really dictated a lot of who was going to the draft and who wasn't, and how guys were being drafted and when they were being drafted. I mean, just a hugely influential figure in the NBA, to your point. And someone who most people, unless they're like real basketball junkies, but I never heard of. So it's just, I would imagine you learned a ton just having him as a mentor, as someone in your life.
Yeah. I mean, just, I'd submit reports and Marty and Ryan would shred it up or tell me this needs to be better. I really did it for a lot of games for free, because it got me the pass to get into games and talk to different people. And because of my affiliation with those guys, I was able to get a couple coaching jobs in minor league pro basketball leagues that basically closed in the middle of the season, in the middle of the game, and all those things. And it finally got me to a team called the Hollywood Fame, where I worked with Don Casey, the former head coach of the Clippers and the Nets. He's become basically like a second dad to me, and helped me get different jobs, helped me get over Japan. And so from there, there's so many different things, but really I bounced from basketball to sports movies, to training, and traveling all over to different parts of the world and really seeing how people led and taught everything.
You mentioned Japan. Can you just give us some insight into what that experience was like for you as a human being and also as a coach?
It's one of my best experiences. I was hired by a team in Okinawa called the Ryukyu Golden Kings. It was an expansion team. We were horrible. I was horrible. I sucked. Now I'm an emotional eater, right? So I love, depending on my emotion, I love to eat. We would lose, and I'd sit there with like ice cream, just like watching film, just chugging ice cream down. It was horrible. Culturally, it was just a tremendous experience, just learning the intricacies part of the culture, but how it embeds into coaching. So for example, in Japanese culture, I can't remember what the term is, but there is basically a hierarchy in terms of where you are when it comes to siblings and on a team. So on our team, we had very, very talented rookies, but the rookies cannot overplay the veterans. So that immediately caused problems, because I needed the rookies to play well, but the veterans didn't allow it. So it was like those things, learning. We traveled all over Japan. It helped because I had already been Asian before. I ate rice a lot, and eat rice a lot in Japan, and I ate rice a lot growing up. So that was a big part of it as well too. But it's by far one of my best experiences. The hardest part though is that, so they signed me to a 2-year contract, were horrible. They let me go. And then the next 3 years in a row, they upped the salary cap. They won the championship 3 years in a row, which drove me crazy, but I was very happy for them because I knew the coaching staff, I knew the players. It was a great humbling experience. Actually, the owner of the team wrote a book on how bad the first season was, and I think trashed me in a chapter. So I was trashed in a chapter in Japanese, so I really don't even know what it says, but that's okay. I'm in a book. It's all I care about.
It's either a new high or a new low, depending on how you look at it. But an amazing experience because you get thrown in there. You have to figure things out. You make mistakes along the way. And I'm sure you just learn. You learn a ton.
Yeah. It was great. It was basically, wow, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, people always say they're never ready for a chapter in their life, right? They're like, Hernando, I'm not ready. I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready for that. And the first thing I say is, like, listen, I'm not ready to be a dad. And I have a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, all right? But the other part is that you really don't know until you just jump in. If you jump in, you're going to have highs and lows, and you know this. If you fail quickly and you get up quick enough from that failure, you learn better, you learn quicker, and allows you to jump back in and see what happens.
Yeah, I think there's such a balance to be struck there because, like, on one end, I think fear of failure is actually very healthy. I think athletes have to have a little fear of failure. That's what is going to cause them to make the decision to eat a salad versus a cheeseburger and fries. That's what's going to help them, you know, get the work in. That's what's going to help them work on their craft. Like Serena Williams, Michael Strahan, Kobe Bryant, Derek Jeter. I have quotes from all those guys that they feared failure. I think the key is that they feared failure in their preparation so they could be fearless when they're performing. And so I think Silicon Valley has really sort of created this monster of fail forward and fail fast. And so in the corporate world, we hear it all the time, like fail forward, fail fast. And I'm just hesitant to say that because failure isn't always good. Yeah, it's helpful when we learn, like it's a great learning experience, but the goal shouldn't be to constantly fail. The goal should be to be successful. So I like to separate fear of failure from a preparation standpoint and then be fearless when we're performing. And if we're fearless and we fail, then we go back to figuring out, all right, how the hell am I going to make sure I don't fail again? So I'm sure when you go through that experience, you're reflecting and now there's a fear in you to say, I never want to have that happen again. And I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that doesn't happen again. But fear, you know, if we just went through our whole life fearless, we would probably drink and drive. We might do crazy drugs. We might eat whatever the heck we want. So I think the key is to be fearless when we're performing. But that's just sort of my soapbox, the way I have thought about fear of failure and fearlessness, because many people will just say don't fear failure. And I'm sure you've been on teams that had no fear of failure going into a game. And so they didn't prepare. They didn't watch film. They didn't read the scout. They might have gone out the night before, and then they lose to a team that they shouldn't have lost to. So that's the push-pull that I have sort of made sense of and logically. Take me back to the States. You come back from Japan, you're back in the States. And by the way, did you leave your family when you went to Japan, or did they come with you?
No, they came with me. And that was a thing. Like, I absolutely agree with you on the failure, about everything that you said. For me, it was odd. I was never afraid to jump into trying different things. And it's probably because the way I was raised from my mom, it's having that good base. I was afraid of other things, but I wasn't necessarily afraid of making the wrong decision or what is going to happen here. But that's sort of my personality as well, too. Like, I don't dabble in stuff. I'm in, either I'm all the way in or I'm all the way out.
That just had me think, like, yeah, we don't want to fear effort. We don't want to fear trying our best. That is not going to be productive when we're preparing or performing. So that's what you were fearless in the sense of, I'm going to go all in and I'm going to give this everything I can. And that, you're right, because sometimes we don't always give max effort or put ourselves out there or make ourselves vulnerable because of fear of getting burned. And I think that is different. So I'm glad you actually separated that, because I think that's a key ingredient too. It's like fearing effort is where we run into a lot of trouble. And I think a lot of people do. They're afraid to put the work in and to make them look bad. And especially at the high school level, you see it a lot because kids want to look cool. When I was in high school, that was paramount for me. So I get that notion. I think that's a really good notion. So you have your family though in Japan. with you. So they're experiencing all this as well, which had to have been just amazing. How old were they at the time?
Yeah, so my son was 7, and so my daughter was 5 or 4, 4 or 5, around that age, yeah, around six, that 6 or 7 age. So it was great for them. You know, I just always encourage always people, you got to spend some time overseas or something that's something that may not be comfortable. And they did. I mean, my son went to, he didn't go to Japanese school, but he was in a Japanese environment, which a lot of kids spoke Japanese and he did not. And it's funny. I mean, I'm sure you know, cause you have kids, but you see them in a setting that they have a way just to be in any setting. It's when they get older, they're like, oh, I can't talk to these people. No way. But it's like, really? You did when you were like 4, man, come on. You know? So, but it was great. It was a great overall experience for them, even though we were losing, I got let go. I didn't know what was next. You know, those questions that a lot of people, don't think about when they're moving overseas. The other part is, you know, when you go overseas, when you have that family context, like, what are you going to eat? What are you going to buy? I can't read anything. I drive on the other side of the road. All those things that really made the experience better and sometimes not so great.
Two thoughts. So I minored in African American studies in college. And for those that can't see me because this is a podcast, I'm not African American.
He's not, guys. I swear he's not.
Shocker. But for me, one of the great things was just being in class with people and thinking about something before I raised my hand. Thinking about how I phrased it and being aware of how I would phrase things or how I would say things because I was the minority. And I think that's an amazing experience that everyone in our society should go through at some point, is being the minority. And by the way, that could be someone who is living in a largely African American community and having them experience in a white community, or someone who's heterosexual and having them surround the anxiety that you feel and the feelings you have in your body when you realize, like, maybe I should phrase this a certain way, or maybe I just shouldn't say anything at all. And
right.
Those are just massively important moments and teaching moments. And then I went abroad to Madrid, Spain.
I love Madrid.
So like, I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember being in that country and all I wanted to do was make sure I wasn't the ugly American. Like that was, like, I was so scared of representing my country in a bad way.
Yeah.
But you're right. You have to point, you have to try to use your face, you have to use body language, and there's so much that goes into it. And Spain isn't Japan when it comes to culture, but there's different cultures. I go to a restaurant at 2:30 and they're like, sorry, we're closed, it's siesta time. I'm like, but I'm hungry. Sorry,
I'm hungry,
sorry.
Man.
No, but I have money. No, we don't want your money. Sorry. Just learning how different cultures act is massively important and builds our self-awareness. And so that's a really cool takeaway that you were able to, and a gift that you were able to give to your family and your kids. And I would imagine, what was that like coming back to the U.S. and sort of where did you guys move from there? And what was the next stop in your journey?
Yeah. So moved back to LA and was trying to find a job. I didn't want to be in LA, to be honest. So I kind of just said one day in August, all right, packing up the U-Haul, moving to North Carolina. And everybody's like, why North Carolina? Well, I said, well, I could continue doing some scouting work for Marty Blake. It's the hotbed of college basketball. And didn't know anybody. Got on the U-Haul, drove the 3,000 miles, landed in North Carolina. Luckily, we got here safely. We found a place. I wasn't working for maybe 4 months. I got a part-time job at a school. I'm kind of like an athletic director and also the basketball coach at a school for kids that specialized with kids with ADHD and Asperger's and dyslexia. Entirely new world for me. I was like, wow. So I did that basically for 2 years, going back and forth, going back to LA, doing some commercial work. Still trying to go to all these different pro camps to try and get it. And then I got a job with the Celtics and their D-League team, the Maine Red Claws. At the same time, I'm working the camps all here, Coach K's camp and Coach P's camp here at Duke. Just trying to really make ends meet.
Is that Danny Ainge's son? Is that Austin?
Yeah. So, yeah, it was Austin.
So for those that, once again, don't know, like, they run a pretty good ship up there
yes.
in Maine, right? Like,
yes, they do.
As D-League teams go, a lot of NBA teams don't have affiliates. They're starting to – a lot of them are starting to get into that business where they own the D-League. But, you know, they've been at it, I think, for a decent amount of time, and they really use yeah. that. They send their guys up to Maine. I think there's a pretty good following up there for games. Like,
it's, yeah, there is. It was great.
It's a so that must have been just an amazing experience. And so walk me through that experience, what that was like working with that caliber of basketball player, being around really NBA people.
Right.
What was that like for you?
Well, I think the greatest part of it is the fact that how I got the job. So just like in any job, I had one D-League head coach interview me for the assistant coaching job. And because that one and that one D-League coach interviewed me, I became like the hot name for assistant coach. Like, oh, who's this Hernando guy? So all of a sudden, like 4 or 5 head coaches were contacting me. And none of it worked salary-wise and everything else. And I knew Austin a little bit back and forth. And I knew the John Jennings was a former Celtics assistant coach who ended up owning the team. And I knew him, and he was trying to push me a little bit. And so the first year that Austin was head coach, his staff was already set up. The next year I spoke to him. I said, hey, I'd really love for you to consider me to be your assistant coach. He told me that, hey, I already offered the job to somebody, you know, just stay in touch with me. Great. I was like, great. Well, there goes my chance. 2 weeks later, I called him back and I said, hey, Austin, just checking in, man. He goes, hey, the guy didn't take the job. You want the job? I was like, what? Yeah, I'll take it. So, you know, so I take it. So I ended up going up there. The crazy part is that my head coach's family lives in Portland, Maine. So I called them. I wanted to see how that was. The kids stayed down here with their mom. I drove up there. It was just a great experience because you're working with the guys who are on the cusp of getting into the NBA. I love the D League, but the players hate the D League. You know, they're not staying in 5-star hotels. You know, you give them their $40 per diem. They're like, wait, where's my cook? Where's my chartered plane? Where's all this other stuff? And I had never been in snow before, lived in snow, being from California. So I did not have a winter coat. My winter coat was like this. It was really skin thin. But working with the guys every single day, focusing only on basketball, breaking down film, doing player development workouts, was absolutely great. It was a huge eye opener for me. It was something that I really, really loved and enjoyed, and wanted to stay in it really. But after the end of the season, Austin decided to resign. I tried to become the head coach of the Maine Red Claws. Obviously that didn't work. So instead, 4 months later, I brought in a group of Brazilian high school basketball players, about eight or nine of them. Actually, they had just finished high school, so they're in that post-grad year. I trained them for 4 or 5 months. We played a schedule up and down the East Coast. That's how I made money. And then I got a call to go coach in the Philippines in March of that year, and I was there for about 4 months. And came back, was unemployed again. And then our head coach here said, hey, I've got a great low paying non-coaching job on my staff if you want it. I said, yes. I was at the NBA Summer League trying to get a job one more time. And, the director of basketball operations called me and said, hey, Hernando, coach wants to hire you. That's fine. Are you done with college? And I was like, no. She's like, well, we can't hire you. I'm like, yeah, but everyone else has hired me. She goes, well, we can't. It's fine. Hung up the phone. Thought about it. Called her back 10 minutes later. Said, all right, how long do I have to finish? She said, well, we're going on overseas tour. You got 5 weeks. I'm like, all right, great. I'll get it done. She goes, are you sure? I'm like, yeah. So I chipped away as time went on. So I had to finish a statistics class, which I had failed 2 times before, and a speech class. And I was going to Regis University. They have a great online program. They're in Denver, Colorado. They're also a quote-unquote real university with a standalone campus. And I invited my neighbors over to the house. I had 10 of them sitting down, and I did my speech, sent that tape out to Regis. I found that Western Washington University had a go-at-your-own-pace statistics class. Got that first week, had no idea what I was doing. Went on Craigslist, found a tutor to help me get it done in 3.5 weeks. Got it done. Got hired at Duke, got my first paycheck, and said, what am I doing with my life? Because I cannot support my kids with this money. So my first 6 months at Duke, I had different jobs. I worked at Duke full time. I did trivia at restaurants. You know, when you go to the restaurants and you like trivia night, I was a trivia night host. I work for Synergy, and for Synergy is the basketball breakdown video company. With that, and
for those
I also
that don't know Synergy. Synergy is if you are a coach, scout, anything in basketball, Synergy is it's a complete game changer. I used to have an NBA
draft. It's heaven for basketball people.
I had an NBA draft website, and I had access to Synergy, and people are like, how do you know so much about these players? I'm like, oh, Synergy. It's almost like cheating. It's like having the it's like Cliff Notes.
It is.
Because the way Synergy works is you basically click on a player. Synergy has multiple uses, but the way I used it was I'd click on a player to scout, and I would just watch clip after clip after clip after clip of that player. Rather than going on YouTube and watching a highlight film, which doesn't tell you at all about a player because you don't get to see them miss, Synergy, you really get to watch a player. So really cool company for those that don't know. And
yeah,
I'm sure it was fun to sort of work for them on the side.
No, it was great. I mean, they gave me opportunity. And then I started a company called Resumes for Coaches, which I basically did resumes for coaches. I made them all look pretty. I put pictures and graphic art on and everything else and showed those packages until some people left Duke and my head coach says, hey, I'm going to put you on the road. And that was it.
You coach women.
I coach women now. Yeah. First women's job ever is at Duke University.
Differences. What's that like for you? Any stories along the way that have impacted you?
You know, a lot of people always ask like, wow, how do you like the women's game? And the first part, I love it. I love it for a lot of reasons. I love it because of the players. The players are awesome, work hard, and not to discredit men's basketball because they work hard. Everyone works hard as well too. It's just a different flavor in many ways in terms of like people say the gratitude or they shoot better, but there's just something different that it's really hard to put your finger on. The second part why I love it is they gave me an opportunity. Like every opportunity I was at the pro level, I would try to get a college men's job. And the first thing they would say is like, nope, you don't have a recruiting experience. Or, what a lot of coaches won't tell you is that they have to hire a minority hire and I'm not necessarily the right minority. So it was part of that. And the other part is I love my boss. My boss is the best boss I've ever had. Just in terms of professional growth and personal growth. She helped me a lot of different things. She helped me when I got divorced, helped me with that process. And just overall, just the different things that the women's game has given my life, has been unbelievable on my personal journey. And I was telling, you know, it's not like, you know, a lot of guys wake up and grow up saying, I want to be a women's basketball coach, right? It's like, I want to coach basketball. And then we all go to the men's side. But if you listen to what you say, I just want to coach basketball. It really doesn't matter, men or women. And now I'm on the women's side.
Well, I think your purpose is really what dictates that, right? So why are you coaching? I'm imagining it's to serve others, to help people grow, to help them develop. And it's interesting because I'm a basketball guy at heart and love basketball. That's the sport that I've always been in love with from a young age. And no one told me that a 5'6", unathletic, 100-something pound guy you might want to stick to a different sport, but that's neither here nor there.
Passion, baby, passion.
Yeah, like I played basketball last night from 9 o'clock at night till 10:30 at night. I tore my ACL a couple years ago playing basketball. Last night was the first time.
You're a warrior, man.
First time I've been back on the court. Honestly, it's been almost 3 years, and my ACL is not. I'm not Adrian Peterson. Let's just put it that way. So I get back on the court last night, and the guys are like, where you been? How long has it been? And luckily they recognized me. I hadn't balded too much, and I think physically I look kind of the same. But that feeling of being back on the court again was so awesome, and that sport just does it for me. The flow of it, the team aspect of it, it's just beautiful for me. But I say all that. I've worked with synchronized ice skating. I've worked with wrestlers. I have worked with golfers, tennis, football, soccer, softball, baseball. You name a sport, rowing. You name a sport, I've probably worked with them. And what I always tell people are like, oh, what sport do you like working with the most? I'm like, look, basketball is a sport I understand best. That's the language I know how to speak. But who I like working with are people that want to get better, that are interested in learning and growing. And that pay on time. Like, those are my ideal clients. They want to get better. They're interesting, and they want to pay, and they pay on time. Like, for me,
that's important.
Yeah, those are the people that I love working with. And I've been fortunate to work with NBA players, NFL players, Major League Soccer. And those people can be great or not, just like any human. And I've worked with 12-year-olds that have been amazing to work with. And they could be in the sport that I know nothing about. And for me, it's really about the human. And I work locally in the D.C. area with a school that you're probably aware of, with Paul the Sixth. I work with their boys and girls basketball teams. And both of their programs are national caliber programs, elite levels. And I love working with the girls. It's awesome. And look, they give me eye contact. They are engaged.
Right.
They are present. And the guys, I love working with them too. And they are competitive, and they are obsessed, and they have dreams, and there's amazing things about that. And so I completely understand what you're talking about, which is just, it gives you an opportunity to impact people's lives. Right. And I think that's probably a really fulfilling thing for you. At Duke, you're working with some of the best women's basketball players in the world. What is that experience like? What are the expectations like? How do you deal with that? Because people are going to play at Duke not because they – well, look, Duke's a little different because I'm sure a lot of them also want the academic experience.
Right.
And that's probably a big draw for them. So you're getting a special caliber human being there. But what's it like as far as, you know, expectations and standards and accountability and that sort of stuff?
Well, I think I know they're extremely high. I mean, the expectations are high every minute of every day at Duke. You know, the pressure is there to win just like in any place, but also try and get these, you know, young ladies going in a great direction for their life. And it's a struggle for them and for any student athlete at any institution. And here at Duke, just the demands they are academically, you know, here at Duke, it's also an experience, right? You're a student athlete, you do extracurricular activities, you're part of this group, you're part of that group. It's an experience here. And so you get a student athlete that is experiencing so much more, and they want more. You know, they want more instruction, they want more opportunities, they want more experience. Not to say that other student athletes don't, but here the exposure they get is unbelievable. But it's just like a lot of other places too. There are expectations. We want to win. They want to win. They want to do well in school. But at the same time too, it's like you're meeting some really, really cool people here that's going to help you, propel you when you stop playing. And in women's basketball, that's a lot sooner than in men's basketball.
And from a mentality standpoint, a culture standpoint, what are things that you guys try to instill in your athletes from a mental standpoint? And then if you were to define the culture that you're creating or you have created, what does that look like at Duke?
Well, I mean, toughness is a big part of it. Character is a huge part, which all comes in play in recruiting, and we could enhance that when they get here. But it's almost one of the reasons why I enjoy my head coach, because it's almost like the same traits that I was growing up, you know, in terms of their hard work, doing the right thing, doing what you're supposed to do, working hard, all those different things that a lot of parents and coaches say, and we are still instilling it over and over every single day. And sometimes we got to word in a different way. Sometimes we have to do it in just a different, not language, but in their language in a way. You know, I'm a big believer in bringing laughter in your environment. And I think an old school way of coaching is like, oh, we just got to be serious and it's game time. You know, sometimes you just got to relax, put a smile on your face, have a little laughter. In my opinion, doesn't mean you focusing less. It's just the way you are dealing with it. It's the way you were brought up dealing with it. And now you go ahead and out there and execute.
Yeah. My take on that is everyone's different. So I think Kevin Garnett probably not going to need to laugh before a game, but maybe Big Baby did,
right.
You know, and that's okay. It doesn't make him any less tough. It doesn't make him any less focused, to your point. And I think I had a high school coach that I worked with once who would always tell his guys to play with joy. And that would be the last thing.
That's great.
That would be the last thing he'd tell his guys every single game. He would end the sort of talk, and he'd always end it this way. He'd say, today is the most important game of the year. And they could be playing the worst team. It didn't matter. Today is the most important game of the year. Go out there and play with joy. And I always loved that. That was how they went out. And you better believe that team.
I love that. I'm writing that down.
Yeah, it's a great one. It's not my line. It's Coach Randy Bisola.
It's all right.
Coach Randy is out in San Francisco. He coaches high school ball out there. And brilliant guy, mentor to me. First basketball team I ever worked with. I had an internship with Coach Randy. They pressed the entire game. They, before even analytics came around, they would only shoot threes and layups, no mid-range jump shots.
Right.
They had this is a male team. They didn't have a single guy above 6'2". And they were awesome. And yeah, they ran dribble drive motion. Awesome. But he really understood the human element. And Coach Randy, maybe I'll get Randy on the podcast sometime. He's a fascinating guy, a really smart dude. He went to Columbia for undergrad, so he's smarter than the two of us. He's a bright dude. And I could get into his story, but let's stick with you. So one of the things that I think intrigued me about you as I sort of got to know your background is you're not somebody who just stays in his lane. You're not somebody who...
no, they hate me for that.
Right? Like, I mean, look, like I interviewed a guy on this podcast who worked for the CIA, and he told me like his thing was I stayed in my lane and I had fun doing it. I don't like to stay in my lane either. Like I like working, as I said, with all kinds of different athletes. We had a thing in grad school where they talked to us about, you know, find your niche. Like, what's your niche? And I was like, I don't want a niche. I want to work with people.
That's right.
And I'm like, if I just did basketball and I was just working on the mental side of basketball and that's the only thing I did in my life, that'd be a pretty boring life for me. I like doing different things. Now I could do different things inside of basketball. But I like the variety. So tell me about all the different things you do. You talked about the resume. I know you have a podcast, but give us paint some color around, what your life is like, what some of the things you do, and just expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. I have a very fancy title. I'm the associate head women's basketball coach at Duke. It says it on my business card. That I don't know why we have business cards anymore. They just sit in my box. I just text people all the time, but no, you know, so the first thing I do obviously is just support my head coach, Coach P, in any way possible. I don't like saying oversee the staff. I like to say work with the staff in conjunction so that we could be successful. I'm also a recruiting coordinator, so I coordinate all our recruiting efforts and where we're going, what we're doing, how we're going to attack each recruit, because everybody is special and you have to go treat them as such, and you have to have a game plan for every single person. And of course, do player development workouts and call the players, make sure our players are good, show them love, make sure that everything that they're doing is great and on point. And that's like just my professional life, with everything out. The other stuff I do, obviously, I, like you mentioned, I have a podcast called the Be Contagious Leadership Experience, because I think leadership is a huge thing and you have to experience life in everything that you do.
Before you go forward, why contagious? Yeah. What's the word contagious mean to you?
Well, I loved it because it catches people off guard, right? It's basically when you say that someone's contagious, means you have a cough or a sneeze or a disease. Yet I'm a big fan of like just a disease of energy. Now, you know, on the website, alwaysbecontagious.com, there's a section on there called Juice, which basically is just understand its crazy energy. And if you've got great energy, if you have great enthusiasm, and it can become contagious to others, just like negativity can be contagious on your team, so can joy and love and laughter and energy for it. So it's always like stuck with me in many ways. And I said, if we're going to start something, we're going to really be contagious and bring that contagious atmosphere to everywhere.
I don't know if you are aware of this, but like two of the most contagious things are smiles.
Yes.
I'm smiling.
Yes.
And they've done like studies where people would smile over the phone and try to sell people products, and they were more successful because they're smiling. So smiles are contagious and yawns are contagious.
Yeah.
So just by saying the word
that yawn, I did not know.
Yeah. Just by saying the word yawn. Sorry, guys.
Oh, watch out. I'm not going to yawn.
just by saying the word yawn, you're more likely to yawn. And so hopefully some people will listen to this and maybe they'll yawn. So
start yawning.
I think that's interesting because you have on one side, you've got smiling and being able to like get people to smile, on the other side yawning, which is like, you know, maybe not something a team wants to do. Although Malcolm Brogdon, he would yawn before games to help himself relax. So there's that. But the idea that we are contagious and what we're putting out the world, man, that's awesome. Energy, anyone that's been involved in any team, not just sports, knows how energy can be contagious. And it's one of the things I pride myself on. Every time I walk into a locker room or a facility, it's like, as soon as I step in there, I need to bring the energy. And it doesn't matter. I've got two little kids. We have a 17-month-old and a 12-week-old.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of wow. It's not a whole lot of – sleeping at night is not happening.
It's foreign to you, man.
Yeah, like, woo. You know, they're good kids. But one of them, it's like – sometimes it's like an orchestra going off with just crying in the middle of the night. And oh, it's just man. Like – a decision is like a back and forth with my wife. Do you get them? Do I get them? Do we let them just cry it out?
Oh, yeah.
In that stage.
You get them. Oh, I get them.
Yeah, but I will say, I still can bring the energy. Like, I can still bring the energy. Not that I don't value sleep. I value sleep as much as anybody. But, you know, if I don't get a good night's sleep, that doesn't mean I can't bring the energy. I don't have that luxury. I'm getting my paycheck, and I have responsibility and obligation to bring it. So I love the idea of being contagious.
Yeah.
So you have – that you have a website, you have a podcast,
right?
Are you still doing the resumes, or is that something?
No. I sold that. Couldn't do it anymore. I didn't want to do it. As I went through this, and I got divorced almost four years ago. So that was another big turning point in my life in terms of, all right, now I'm settled into me. I'm no longer afraid of certain things in my life, and now I could really push forward. I'm a big believer that you got to try and follow the advice you would give other people, or at least try to. You know, so many of us love to give advice to people, yet we aren't strong enough to follow that advice. So what if we try to be that strong? What if we made the choice to have intention to follow that advice? And if we follow the advice we would tell other people, the amazing thing is that everything that our parents told us, do the right thing, work hard, will all come back to what it is. And then the other part, to touch on the contagious part, being contagious gives you a choice, right? It gives you a choice to in which direction you want to go in. If you people don't wake up just happy, right? I mean, that alarm goes on at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning. You're saying a couple curse words. No, you got to make the choice to wake up, be happy for yourself, to others, and really make an impact with other people.
And understand that emotions have a shelf life. So even your mom, who is this passion, this emotion, she wasn't happy all the time. She wasn't,
right.
You know, there were times of silence for her. And you sort of intimated this earlier in the sense that you're a social person like your mom, but you like to sort of have your quiet time, maybe like your dad. We're not one way all the time. Like no one's happy all the time. No one's sad all the time. Nobody's energetic all the time. But the more that we can be thoughtful and intentional with how what we're giving off to the world, the more aware we are of what we're giving off to the world, the better we'll be. The more we work from the inside out rather than the outside in, the better off we'll be. And I like to think about emotions as they have a shelf life. They will expire, and you know, when they expire, you need to choose what's going to take their place. But nobody intentionally is trying to be angry. Like, no one wakes up in the morning saying, like, today's a great day to be angry. anger tends to be reactive, and it's an emotion, and the key is to shorten the shelf life of anger. But if we never felt anger or frustration or anxiety, we wouldn't know what happiness or joy or being nice to people, what that's like. So
that's right.
I think we have to honor and respect the emotions because they are useful. And but as a team and as an organization and at our job, we need to go in there with intention, because if we just leave it to our mind's going to go to those different places and they may not be helpful for us to do our job well. And so when you have a team and you're practicing for 2 hours, we only got those 2 hours. We don't have the luxury of having you come in with the drama that you have in a relationship or the issues that you're having in school or class or whatever it might be. So that is why being in the moment is so valuable when we are performing, because if we are where our feet are, if we are doing what we're supposed to be doing right then and there, we're going to give ourselves a better opportunity to be successful. So, that push-pull is something that I think is important. And I don't think we teach enough that anxiety is okay, that it's normal, that self-doubt does not discriminate. Everybody has self-doubt. It's just that people shorten the shelf life on self-doubt rather than expanding it and drinking spoiled milk when it's already, when that shelf life has expired.
Right.
So that's sort of how I like to think about it. I want to also get your perspective on coaching. So what are the tenets of coaching that you think are most valuable? You sort of gave some ideas as far as what your job and what your role is as an assistant coach or as an associate assistant coach. But what are the tenets that you've seen amongst great coaches? You've been around a lot of, what are the things that you see that great coaches do?
Well, a lot of them were, you know, they're disciplined in terms of, and notice I say disciplined, not organized, disciplined in terms on how they approach on what they really see the vision of the program is. That's one part. I think the other part is their accountability. They hold everybody to accountability standards. And they want everybody to really be successful. I think the biggest part is that sometimes players think coaches are against them instead of thinking the coaches are really trying to raise them up. And I think the other part, and it's, in this day and age, it's even more important, when you talked about a little bit, is the power of the mind, right? It's the power of the mind that is so important that, you know, people would say more people are more fragile now than before. I don't like to get in the argument. I just like to say, okay, well, what are we going to do to fix it? You know, we know what the problems are. Let's fix it. And I think that's where, you know, for me as a coach and how I deal with our players now and how I've always dealt with them is let's fix it so we can move forward and we can get it going.
Yeah, I'll take on that argument. I think it's complete bullshit. I think the notion that kids today are soft, I think every generation says that about the generation below them.
And, I agree with that, yeah.
It's just a constant thing. It's just today we talk about it more because what? We take in way more information than we used to, and we share way more information than we used to because of social media. And so it's not that kids today are soft. It's just that we're broadcasting that concept more and people are buying into it more because they might hear a story or an anecdote and then it blazes on fire and then everything gets passed around. Look, I do think things change because technology changes. So, you know, having a smartphone is certainly different than when I was in high school and I didn't have a cell phone. Yeah,
right.
That's going to change someone's life. But that's for all of us. Like, we're all addicted to those stupid smartphones. It's not just a 16-year-old. It's the 60-year-old is looking at their smartphone too. So
I think it's for the better though too.
Yeah, it depends how you look at it, right? Like, the ability to get information today and to add knowledge without getting it from school is times 20. It's amazing. And the ability to stay connected to people is an amazing gift. But if we overuse anything, if we overuse any strength, it becomes a weakness. If I'm a left-handed guard and I'm just like dominant getting to my left, but if I only use my left, eventually someone's going to slide over, take a charge, and that's not going to be helpful. Eventually I got to cross over to my right a little bit, even if it's not comfortable, and go with my right. And as a player development coach, that's part of your job, is to say, all right, we're going to pull on your strengths, we're going to make you stronger, but hey, we also have to address some of these weaknesses, because if you don't address those weaknesses, you're not going to be better off for it. So I think it's, I think it's the same. What are your thoughts on technology? Because
First of all, I love it. I think I agree with you, but I think it's hilarious when people talk about how like these phones are ruining people's lives, right? We hold a computer every single day. You know, there's no reason why we cannot be some sort of successful with social media, with reaching out to people. What I love is when people are saying, well, you know, when you're older, they don't go on the phone that much. Listen, here's the greatest thing. If you're 60 and your partner is 60 and you're sitting at dinner, 5 years ago, you're not saying anything to your 6-year-old partner. Now you're on social media and now you may be, you're in the same, but 1 6-year-old man has a phone, the 6-year-old woman has a cell phone, and now they're communicating in different ways and now can have different ways of conversation. I think this is the greatest thing. I think we're getting so much more advanced with everything that we do. I mean, like, the reality is I love it. I used to be against it. I used to tell my son, like, all right, give me the phone, look outside, because we're going to drive for 5 hours. Wait, why? Why? You're going to see the exact same thing. Rocks and mountains. Go on Angry Birds. Fine. Think of something.
Yeah, I think it all depends, right? So if we're at the dinner table and that's the one place where we are going to interact as a family, yeah, you know what? Let's all turn our cell phones off. And by the way, that includes you, mom and dad, rather than just telling your kids to. So yeah, I think it all depends, right? Like, when you're in practice I'm assuming practice wouldn't go really well if everybody had their ringers on and, you know, they were stopping practice to go check out why their Instagram or their Snapchat or whatever's going on. So there's a time for everything. But I agree with you. You know, for me, like, I listen to audiobooks or podcasts when I'm driving. I wasn't able to do that without my smartphone. And now I'm right. gathering information on a drive that, you know, I can do in my sleep. But there's also times where I unplug it, and I think it's valuable to be in my own mind and have that time to explore and just be without audio. I think it's just, if we can build the awareness muscle, if we can build the mindfulness to say, I'm choosing this, I'm choosing that, that's, I think, really valuable. The issue is that I think a lot of people are now addicted to their phones, and they're just swiping it and checking it without, like, they might have checked their email 3 seconds ago. I heard something today. I was listening to an audiobook, and they said the average person is on their smartphones for 11 hours a day. They're interacting in some way with their smartphone for 11 hours a day, and they're checking it every 6 minutes. So, you know, there becomes, as I said, if we use something, if we can overuse things, and that's where addiction happens, right? Like, having a drink won't kill you, but if you have a drink, if you have multiple drinks every single day, now you're talking about addiction. So I think we do need to figure that out as a society, because those phones are programmed to get us addicted to them. So we're constantly on it so they can advertise more and make more money. But there is also tremendous value to be had from social media, from email, from the ability to pick up the phone and find somebody.
Yes.
That stuff's beautiful. That's how we're talking. I don't meet you if not for that. We're not connected if not for that.
Right.
So you wouldn't have come into my life. My life would be just that much worse if I had.
That's right. You wouldn't be contagious, man. No, but I tell you, life is so much better. I love hearing when people forget how life was. Like, oh, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't do that. No, you don't remember what you did, man. I mean, come on. Life is better. You can't. I love when parents say, well, you know, my son or daughter's just not working hard enough. Really? Did you? Like, oh, when I did, I worked hard. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. You know, take a look at your life. Life is better because we do have phone. Yes, we have to manage it better. We can't be in all the time. But I could sit here and go ahead and find a YouTube workout for my own. There's no excuses.
There isn't. And, you know, you hit something else, which is there's a lot of research around the idea that we lie about our past.
We lie.
Like, the older we get, the more we change the story, and we lie about our own story. And so I think as adults, we have to be aware of that, because we are not telling ourselves the correct story. We're lying about it. Although I'm pretty honest about my athletic prowess, which I've shared a couple times today. So I like to think I try to be pretty honest with it. Here's what I want to do, Hernando. We've been talking for a while. I want to end with something I call our preferences. So basically, you're going to pick one of these, and I want you to wear your coach's hat. So I'm just going to give you can pick one of the preferences. So do you prefer preparation or performing?
Performing.
Do you prefer yes sir athletes or why athletes?
Why?
Do you prefer a system or autonomy?
Autonomy.
Perfection or progression?
Progression.
Would you prefer to have the most valuable player or the most improved player?
Oh, wow. That's tough. The most valuable player. I'm trying to win, man.
Do you prefer your generation or your parents' generation?
My generation.
Yeah, we just got into that a little bit, I think. Do you prefer evaluations or descriptions?
Evaluations or descriptions? Descriptions.
Positive feedback or negative feedback?
Wow. Can I just say feedback?
Yeah, I mean, they're all loaded, right? Like, the idea here is that they're loaded questions. Let me ask you that question a different way. As a coach, if you're getting feedback, let's just say I was observing you, would you prefer that I give you positive feedback or negative feedback?
Yeah, I mean, positive feedback.
Culture or talent?
Culture.
Momentum or the moment?
The moment.
Pumped up or calmed down?
Pumped up.
Grit or grind?
Grit.
Liked or respected?
Respected.
transformational leadership or transactional leadership?
Ooh. Transactional.
Love winning or hate losing?
Love winning.
Risk taker or rule follower?
Wait, risk taker or what?
Rule follower.
Risk taker.
Would you prefer as a player to be a starter on a losing team or a towel waiver on a winning team?
A towel waiver. Absolutely.
Yeah, why is that absolutely for you?
To be a towel waiver?
Yeah.
Because I want to go ahead and be part of a culture and see what wins. Like that is where I think I'd be, for me, a much better student at it. I mean, you could learn a lot from the game, but you know, if I'm the best player on a losing team, it's all about me.
You know what's interesting about that question, which I hadn't thought of until you were talking? I don't know if you remember Patty Mills a couple years ago.
Like, yeah.
He literally did all these drills to show the different towel waving ways that he was like, he had like the whip or the, like, you know, he like wrote a whole article about all the different types of ways he would use a towel. And now, you know, Tony Parker out, he's basically the starting point guard on the San Antonio Spurs. So it's just interesting to think about him. Like, when I think of towel waver, I think of Patty Mills because he really like, he loved talking about waving the towel, but then he was a starter on a winning team, so he got to experience that as well. Balance or specific obsession?
Ooh, wow, these are great. Balance or specific obsession?
Yeah.
Balance.
Fear of failure or fearlessness?
Fearlessness.
Disassociate from pressure or embrace it?
Embrace it.
Head or gut?
Ooh, man. Head.
You are now off of the preference hot seat.
I was like, man, these are good.
Yeah, just like rapid fire. I love just seeing people's interpretation because they're not necessarily right or wrong. It's just how you see it. So that's what's fun about it. What I'd like to do is just end with this. Tell us where we can find you. I know you're active on social media. Let people know where they can find you or if they want to learn more about you. Give yourself a plug. Plug away, Hernando.
Oh, that's bad news for everybody. No, you know what? First of all, Brian, I appreciate you having me on, man. This has been awesome. Absolutely, absolutely awesome. I really, really enjoyed it. Well, you know, I have a website. It's alwaysbecontagious.com. All one word, alwaysbecontagious.com. It's where you can kind of see some of our services. We do a lot of workshops with sports teams and businesses and individuals. But everything's really done through improv activities that I did with actors and players and people in general. And we really focus on the leadership, the communication, the culture part. Basically being in a role where you think you cannot do, but you really have the person inside you. And it really ties into social media because we're trying to take people – they have two personas, right? The social media person and then their personal life person. Sometimes when you combine the two, you really get the best version of yourself. And we see that a lot with athletes in terms of what we see with our college athletes. And really, I'm huge on social media. Instagram is probably really my go-to. It's Coach HB Jr. But the reality is you just got to write in basketball, Hernando on Google, and you'll find everything you want to know and don't want to know about me, including all my social media. I'm on Twitter at Hernando Jr. I'm on Facebook. But I really love, we started doing the podcast. We're about, 9 episodes in with the Be Contagious Leadership Experience. It's similar to yours, Brian. We really just try and get a lot of different thought leaders, a lot of different people who are out there and kind of tell them what has worked for them and their journey and their experience and everything else. One of the things that I really tell people is that, you know, your journey can go up and down and go in so many different ways. And I tell everybody, you know, they ask me, Coach, did you always want to coach growing up? And I was like, no, I saw a guy wearing a suit and tie yelling at people. And that's what I wanted to do. That's why I wanted to get into coaching. And I realized that it's so much more. And in my life, I've been really open to other opportunities. So when I wanted to coach overseas, I wanted to coach in Europe because that's where everybody wanted to go. Well, I didn't coach in Europe. I went to Asia, right? I wanted to coach in the NBA. Well, I didn't coach in the NBA. I coached the NBA D League, and I wanted to coach high level college men's basketball, and I didn't do that. I coached women's basketball, and I'm very happy. Love my journey and everything else, but it shows you that you really can go in a different direction. And that's where the podcast, the website, the social media, all that stuff really, really comes from.
Awesome. Hernando, you got a great story. I love how adaptable you've been over the years and being able to adjust and being able to stay on your feet even when you get knocked down. Love meeting you. It's been fun. I'm sure you'll come through DC either in recruiting or for a game. So hopefully we can grab lunch and chat and catch up in person. I promise I'm not as I think I'm better in person. I think I'm better in person.
I think we all are. Hopefully,
I hope so. You know, it's a little awkward doing a video thing, but I'm good with it. Thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
All right, thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Thanks.